James Jenkins, one of the early residents of Mill Valley. She was a very close friend of my mother, so I'm going to call her Aunt Dolly.
Good.
Aunt Dolly, let's put this historically a little bit. When did your grandparents, was it?
Yes.
Come to Mill Valley originally?
Well, my grandfather and my grandmother were married in San Francisco. One of them came from Providence, Rhode Island, and the other came from, well, I can't say it anymore. And my grandfather, as far as I know, there are a few mysteries about this. As far as I know, he was a homeopathic physician. I was always brought up to believe so. But a couple of the historians of Marin County said, oh no, he wasn't, he was a druggist. Or he was the kind of doctor that was in California in those days, that everybody called him Doc because he knew how to bind a wound. I don't know why they told me that, because the book that was written in 1900 gives him as a physician. And in the other day I went down to the library here in San Francisco and looked up an old register. And in the old register, it shows him as a doctor, and with two addresses, one apparently an office and the other his home, which went on from the middle 60s until around 72 or 73, 1872 or 73. Yeah. And I had always been told that my grandfather's health was failing, and that he and my grandfather looked for a place in the country where he could end his days. And my father, about 1873, my father was 17, my aunt was 14, and in failing health, I suppose he decided he couldn't practice anymore. And they heard of this property that was left out of the old Spanish grants. One of them had 150-some acres. Both of them had 150-some acres in them with odd numbers. And one in the Cotamadera del Presidio and the other in the Sausalito grant. So they applied for a homestead, to homestead it. Applied for a patent, I think you call it. And as a matter of fact, there was a lot of difficulty, and I don't know what that was all about. They didn't get the patent until about 1883. I can give you those exact dates a little bit later. But on this property, here's the great mystery as far as I'm concerned. On this property was a very darling little house. And I had always been told, there's an oil painting of it been in the family for a long time, and I was always told that an Englishman lived in it, but I never was interested enough to ask any more questions than that. And obviously it must have been given up or vacant. They couldn't have applied for a patent if somebody else owned the property, certainly. And they settled in this little house and immediately began building small cottages about the place. And I can remember, and I've only just discovered why, there was one cottage called the Parlor Cottage. And I don't think I've ever went in that cottage, but I'm sure there were bedrooms upstairs, and there must have been a rather large room downstairs. And the small house in which my grandfather lived and my grandmother, I imagine they turned into the downstairs into a dining room and used the kitchen. There were Chinese servants. I have these pictures of a Chinaman in a play that they had standing in the foreground with scenery, ship going to China, and so forth. I imagine they were his old patients. I'm trying now to make up a sort of a hotel roster of the people that came over there, because it was every big name that you ever heard of in San Francisco. And they came summer after summer, and the place grew and grew and grew. My grandfather only lived until 1879, and but they kept on using it as a hotel.
Where was it? Down in the flat area by West Blithedale?
No, well, let me see, how could I, you know the road up to the Ross and White? You know where, do you know where Helen Clinton lives?
Yes.
Well, you know there's a big clump of trees in the middle of the road.
Right.
The road.
Mm-hmm.
And Ripley once wrote that up as the smallest park in the world, which was, of course, a silly thing, but that was just left in the middle of the road, and my mother had to deed the property to the town to preserve those trees. Well, it began, it really began just slightly above where the Outdoor Art Club is.
Oh.
And it went right up that canyon to a little way up the mountain. And up to the top of the hills on the Corte Madera side. I know Mother paid taxes in Corte Madera.
Oh, really?
Went over those hills and not all the way down.
And the hotel part was there in the flat?
Everybody that talks about Blithedale and writes about Blithedale say it was to be a sanitarium. Now, I've heard my mother say over and over again, it never was going to be a sanitarium. And since I've been looking up these old dates and these old things, I'm perfectly sure that she was right, because my grandfather was a dying man, apparently, when he went over there. He died a very few years after they retired over there. And had he not been, he wouldn't have given up his practice in San Francisco.
Right.
So it was a lovely place for people to come and maybe recuperate, but the cottages were kind of grim for in this present day. Well, I mean, I don't think there was any hot water. I don't think, I mean, things that we're used to, they didn't, of course they didn't. Where did they get, so many things I want to know. They couldn't have gotten ice. Where did they get ice? When they went over, there was no railroad going from Sausalito up anywhere for the first few years. So they had to drive all the way to Sausalito to get on a boat. Later, the railroad started, and it I think about 75, and it crossed the bay over to and landed in, on a trestle, and landed at the end of Strawberry Point, and then it went up the other side of Strawberry Point and came back and crossed, I imagine there was a road there at that time, and went on through the cut that is now still there.
Really?
And they used to, when that happened, they used to drive in a great big coach and four to meet the trains. And there were six gates to open between Blithedale and the gates. Another thing that interests me, these little skippy things that I'm saying.
Great.
But, for instance, there was no Mill Valley. You stop and think of maybe they'd go down. Why didn't they shop in Mill Valley? There was no Mill Valley. There was nothing. There were no houses at all down there. Maybe one or two little, the Reeds had a house. One or two little things, but nothing, no stores, nothing of that kind. And so I don't know where they could have gotten their supplies or how they kept them. But my first recollection, and one of my only recollections of my grandmother, was going into her milk house, which was thick walls of cement and boards, sort of. They look almost like sticks of trees, branches of trees. And there were pans around the place. And my grandmother had a little skimmer, a little thin thing. And she was going around skimming this gorgeous yellow cream that would kind of go like silk in crumplets. And that was one of my early recollections. And later, when the mountain train came into being, the conductors used to point out this milk house and say, that is an old adobe that was built by the Mexicans, one of the oldest buildings around these parts, or anywhere else for that matter. And I always laughed because I knew that it was my grandmother's milk house, and it wasn't an old adobe.
It's still getting... I'd like to ask you another question. Was your father raised in Mill Valley? Did your grandmother stay there after your grandfather died?
Yes, but I wonder where they went to school, where Aunt Marion was 14. I imagine that he went to school just learning building these houses and planning. He learned to survey and he learned to do all those things just by doing them, because they couldn't have commuted for those first 3 years to school. He couldn't have driven to Sausalito, and then there weren't very many boats coming over to San Francisco. There were no schools there. I didn't begin to think about that until I ran pass along.
Yes, until it was too late to ask anybody.
Oh, much too late.
But he did grow up and passed his life in Mill Valley
He grew, well, not in Mill Valley.
In that area.
When you say that, at the time of his death, and also at the telephone exchange and everything, it was just Blithedale. Mm-hmm. You see, there was no Mill Valley until a good many years later.
And in fact, there was Eastland in between. It was Eastland wasn't it?
Eastland and Mill Valley were the same, I think, mm-hmm. more or less. They mm-hmm. called it Eastland for a while, but there wasn't any Eastland. There just wasn't anything but Blithedale.
Did your grandfather call it Blithedale?
Yeah. My grandfather, I should have told you this in the beginning. My grandfather called it Blithedale because he read Hawthorne's Blithedale Romance.
Oh.
And he loved Hawthorne's Blithedale Romance. I got it the other day and read it, and it's a very strange story, but I don't think there were too many novels. It was kind of half mystery and half metaphysical, but it was a great thing in those days. So he loved the name, and he called it Blithedale. Mm. And the other day, riding up to San Rafael, way out on the highway, here across the highway was the name Blithedale. And I said to the children, that's there because your grandfather read a book. which really is true. I mean, it just, but the telephone exchange is listed as Blithedale.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. And that's another thing that I wanted to find to get exactly right. But Mr. in Eastland and my grandmother had the first two telephones in Marin County, in that part of the county. And the advertisement boasts that you could telephone to San Francisco and Santa Rosa and Petaluma and San Rafael, but you couldn't telephone after a certain hour in the evening. And I checked to find out how much the telephones, how much you paid in those days. Mm-hmm. And the telephone girl said she couldn't find Mill Valley, but she did find San Rafael about that date. And that they paid by the year, you paid $50 a year.
My.
The telephone, which breaks down to about the same. Mm-hmm. Now, think of what the telephone company has done. You can telephone anywhere in the world, mm-hmm. any time of the year. I don't know about the North Pole, but almost any place mm-hmm. in the world. Mm-hmm. Any time of the day, I mean. Mm-hmm. So,
yes, it is remarkable.
I said in the beginning that the people that came over were all the intriguing and interesting people from San Francisco. I just presume they must have been my grandfather's patients. Mm-hmm. And they were all so talented. I have a picture in the hall, a darling watercolor painting. And I just received from this cousin a lot of poems that they wrote. Hmm. Which is just, there's a darling poem about Blithedale, called Blithedale.
Hmm.
And then here is a picture. I'll show you the picture of the stage if you didn't see it.
Yes, I'd love to see it.
Here. The stage getting ready to go over to Strawberry. Now, in one map that I found in one of the books written about the railroads, it's called Blithedale. And it's the only place that I've seen that the station is called Blithedale. Otherwise, people refer to it as Lyfitts or something of that kind.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But this I'm sure, was done when they first went over there. Oh, it must be because it says off to Sausalito.
You got a letter from Mr. Blake, and he told you that his brother rode at the back of the stage?
He and his brother.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. I didn't hear this.
This is a picture of the Blithedale. What was the name of this establishment?
Blithedale.
Blithedale?
Just the Blithedale Hotel.
Blithedale Hotel.
Mm-hmm. And One day, the California Historical Society called me up. This was in about 1958 or 59. And somebody that I didn't know there said, James, we have a picture here, and it's Marin County, and we think it's very nice, and we want to buy it, but we want the committee to buy it. But they don't like to have things presented to them unless they are named where they are. And we wondered if you might know. I said, how do you know it's Mount Tamalpais? And they said, how do you know it's Marin County? And they said, because Mount Tamalpais is in the background, so it's obviously Marin County. So I went out there, and the instant I saw it, I said, that's my grandfather's place. Now, don't you think that was strange?
Yes.
That I was the one that they called.
Isn't that strange?
And so Jim and I bought it for, and gave it, I kind of wish we'd bought it and kept it, but mm-hmm. The committee gave it to the Historical Society. And they seem to be very fond of it because it's always out there in the library, and then another time it'll be up in the main house. So, and the other day, the two people came from the Historical Society and looked through my photographs, and they want me to name all the cottages. I can name them. This is the parlor cottage, and this is the main, eventually turned into the main house. And this we used to call the yellow house. And this one, I don't know, it was on the top of the hill, but this one was the Moore cottage, and this was the Monteagle cottage, and they came year in and year out to stay there.
Well, after your grandfather died, did your father take over the running of this?
Yes, of course, I don't know what they did every year, but when I was old enough to know what was, pay any attention to what was going on, I think he ran it one year, but otherwise than that, he rented it out to somebody to run. Somebody by the name of Robinson had it for several years. And they did a lot of, Mrs. Robinson was very smart about things. They took the milk house and pulled out the back of it and put a very simple, I think with a fireplace, if I remember correctly, and a pool table. And they made it into a bar, a change from beautiful crinkly cream to spirits. Beside having these cottages, Helen Clinton said you could tell, I remember her saying that you could tell when people got up in the morning because they'd take these showers, just right cold water out of the stream, and there'd be these shrieks from each tent. You'd know just what stage they were in their dressing. And they were not only the rooms in the cottages, but they put up tents in the summertime. And I can remember, usually around the 18th or 20th of June, just as the people had come over with their children when school closed, we'd have a horrible downpour, and all the people in the tents' clothes would get wet, and there'd be these terrific moans and groans from everybody. And beside the Moores and the Monteagles, and several of the others, beside having their rooms in the cottages, the same ones year in and year out, they would have tents set up, or I suppose the hotel set them up for them, where they'd sit in the afternoons and serve tea. It would be the Moore tent. You'd go to the Moore tent for tea in one afternoon, and then somebody else's tent for tea in another afternoon.
Oh, nice.
Many different things would be added. At first, I have some pictures of battledore and shuttlecock, a little tiny court with a little low net, and people with long skirts playing. I think one of them is my mother. And eventually a tennis court was built, and then a sort of a bowling alley. I don't know what you call it. It wasn't an elegant bowling alley, but something where you'd bowl, and these things would go down, and then you'd pull a rod, and the pins would come up again. But games of that kind we used to play, and they used to have charades in the parlor, and a couple of dances every year. The dances, the 4th of July dance, would always be great decorating, and I can remember Japanese lanterns hung between the trees with candles in them. And I can remember my father just sitting on the porch all evening watching the the candles, and I think it must have been the most dangerous thing in the world. And we'd have very impromptu fancy dress parties, and one or two a year. And one year in my teens, there was a very attractive young couple there. I don't know whether it was a Bates that married something that married a Bates, but anyway, this gentleman was very handsome. And I don't know how this was cooked up, but I was supposed to go in his frock coat. He was going to wear his wife's dress. Well, now, if you ever seen a frock coat, they button down the front and they go way down below a man's knees, and they're very, very impressive looking. But I got in horrible trouble because ladies didn't wear trousers in those days. And there was someone called Kathleen Thompson who was at the party, and she later turned out to be
Mrs. Charles G. Harris.
and she wrote me up.
Really?
In the San Francisco papers. Well, was I in trouble? My mother felt disgraced. Everybody, oh boy, how I hated Kathleen for a long, long time. But I forgave her in the end. I would love to see that article now to see if it was as spicy as I remember it to be, or as the results were on everybody looking down their noses at me for having been such a hussy.
Do you remember what year it was, approximately? If you knew Kathleen Thompson, did you know her in Mill Valley when that family lived in Mill Valley?
I didn't know her when Blithedale was sort of separate from Mill, though I did know the Ruth Berkey, I did, and Alice, we did ride horseback, but unless it was somebody that rode horseback, I didn't know them.
You didn't go to school in Mill Valley?
No.
No. Where did you go to school?
Well, I went to the... My schooling was very strange. We don't want that in this.
Oh, yes, we do.
You can ask me where... Well, then turn down and ask me where I went to school.
Where did you go to school?
I went to a Miss Stewart school, a little private school in San Rafael, just a handful of young people. From the time I was about 5 until I was about 12 or 13.
Did you go over in a wagon every day?
No, Miss Stewart's school was in San Rafael. It was just a block and a half from my house. But believe it or not, we all rode ponies to school and had the most wonderful time. The Fosters were there. They were just ponies and ponies and ponies. Almost every child had a pony. And we used to play prisoner's base on ponies on Fifth Street in San Rafael. Scrape out lines and line up and dare each other. Then I went from there to the San Rafael High School, and that was about 1905, I guess. What was the year of the earthquake? Six. Four, I guess, I went to the San Rafael High School. And I stayed there until we were supposed to be behaving badly. Now, behaving badly, I can't imagine anything like it now. We did once in a while have one cigarette. We'd go down in the basement and pass around between 5 or 6 of us, I guess. And maybe that happened 2 or 3 times. And then we had a we had a geometry teacher. Who had very big feet, and we all used to go up and ask him questions and stand on his feet deliberately. But we weren't doing anything very bad, but the mother got worried about me and decided she'd send me for a little bit polish to Miss Murison's school in San Francisco. So I left the San Rafael High School and my dear friends there, and Lou Foster also went to Miss Murison, so we commuted together. But that started in January, '06, and it didn't last very long because in April came the earthquake, and the school was through for that year. And the following year, I went to Mrs. Scoville's Classical School for Girls in New York City, 2042 Fifth Avenue, just now in the depths of Harlem.
Yes.
Just above 125th Street. It was 126th Street and Fifth Avenue. And I stayed there for a year. And that was the end of my going to school.
Then you came back to the county?
I came back and supposedly the next winter came out, which was consisted of, you came out, you were allowed to go to the Greenway balls, and you were allowed to, well, you just had a lot of, there were a lot of parties and things. I didn't have any big coming out splash, but you just began to go the grown-up parties. And
from San Rafael all the way?
From San Rafael all the way. Well, friends in the city would invite me to spend. You couldn't, see, there was only one ferry at around 12 o'clock at night, so you couldn't go to a ball exactly and do that. So I had friends and girls that came out at the same time, and I used to spend the night in the city. And another thing that we did that was such fun was to have these wonderful parties over at, by that time, the Dipsy Inn, right in the middle, it was built right in the middle of the sand spit. And we used to, all the teenagers, 18 or 20 of us would go over in all different forms and manner. I used to ride over, and I have walked over, and some of them would drive over, and we'd stay for one or two nights and just have a gorgeous time.
There was a road over to?
The road, yes, there wasn't the mountain road, but there was the coast road. It was open from, I used to go from Mill Valley mostly. We spent the winters in San Rafael because my mother's house was in San Rafael, and that was the residence most of the year. And I think almost every summer we did go down to Blythedale and spend it there. The one thing that was now entirely outdated was a watering cart that used to go around the Blythedale grounds a couple of times, I don't remember how often, but a good many times a week, drawn by two horses and a big tank at the back, and lay the dust in front of the buildings.
Oh, it wasn't to water the garden at all, it was just to lay the dust.
No, just for the dust. Mm. Well, they were watering carts and all the... This is what intrigues me, this weeping willow tree.
Oh, yes.
Quiet evening in the parlor. And this is Major McClung. And I nearly popped. Somebody from the Historical Society had heard me talking about these pictures, and he saw something in the paper that had been written up from the old days. And Major McClung was shot dead in Lily Coit's room, which was quite intriguing to me. But I was a little disappointed to find that it wasn't a scandal that Mrs. Coit had a relative who collected the rents from her extensive properties for her. And he got the idea that Major McClung was going to get his job away from him. So he popped him off right in front of her.
For heaven's sake.
Not too nice. And in this somewhere, there's Molly Thomas, and there's Mrs. Schmedberg, Grandma Schmedberg, and I don't know what Colonel Schmedberg did. I want to find that out. There's Mr. Moore and Mrs. Monteagle. They were pillars of the Episcopal Church. And every Saturday night in the dining room, my mother used to get very annoyed. I think it was very, very oompty-oomp of them, because the Moore children would stand up. And the Moore and the Monteagle children, they always ate together, they were great friends, and they would stand up around the table at a certain hour on Saturday nights, and they would recite, "And now it is Saturday night. We've tried all the week to be good. We've not done a single bad word, said a single bad word, and we've done everything that we should." Don't you think that's a cute poem? Mother thought that was a little cheeky, though.
Yes. That's right, and far from true.
Now here are the tents.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. See, here are the badminton things. Mm-hmm. But here is the tent with all the people gathered.
Oh,
around.
How cute.
Now here, I think that's a darling picture.
Yes.
Young people. Here's the milk house.
So oh, yes.
You can see that it isn't adobe.
No,
but
it's...
I don't quite know what these...
It's wattle, I think, what they call it in England.
Kind of intriguing. Mm-hmm. This is Duval Moore, at the age of four, and this was taken, he thought, about 1883,
mm-hmm.
and this is this little McClung girl, and this is a fancy dress party. Now, believe it or not, this is Athel McBean.
Everybody.
The McBeans went over there, and I wrote a note to Peter McBean the other day to see if, because I'm sure these people have pictures around
mm-hmm.
that they don't know what they are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they,
mm-hmm.
unless they were very interested, they wouldn't know what they were. But he didn't seem to know anything about it. But Mr. and Mrs. Stuart Baldwin used to go. And Mrs. Baldwin was the first one that told me anything about the McBeans. And they said, I can remember, they used to have, I was curious about what kind of plumbing they had, but she said they were sort of capsule things that were taken out, and I don't know where they were put, but kind of dragged somewhere behind a horse. And that she remembers Athel McBean trying to ride out of the, and that at least 3 or 4 times a week, Mr. William Thomas would sing Old Dog Tray. And that was a great memory for him that he just loved. Nice Chinaman. See the Chinaman with the Q?
Yes.
And I don't know who any of these are.
Are they supposed to be weeping because somebody has sailed away?
Well, don't you see a ship
mm-hmm.
sailing
yes.
away?
Mm-hmm.
And these devils are weeping on the mm-hmm. same handkerchief, don't you see? That probably was very... But look at their clothes.
Yes.
How did they keep them clean? Were there any cleaners in those days? What did you do? Because I... look at the...
Because those were not washables.
Oh, they couldn't have been.
No. What's the ruffles?
They're silkables, they look like.
Yes.
Silks and...
Oh, my.
Isn't that...
Yes, that's marvelous.
But they must have had such fun doing it.
Oh, it must have been a real adventure.
Now, here's
the stage.
And I have another story about the stage.
Good.
When I heard that Mr. Blake went there in the early days, I thought, well, I see him once in a while at an Historical Society meeting, and I'll take the picture of the stage and see if he knows anybody in it, 2 or 3 of my pictures down there. And took it down, and unfortunately he wasn't there that day. And I was walking out, and somebody walking next to me called Helen Ashton, who was a little older than I, and I didn't know too well, and I said, oh, I'm so disappointed. I had a picture of the old Blithedale stage, and I wanted to get Mr. Blake to tell me who the people were. And she said, well, maybe I can. I said, well, nonsense. It was 1883. How could you possibly tell me? And she said, well, let me see it. So I showed her the picture, and she said, well, that's my mother and that's my father before they were married.
Oh, for heavens.
I just had the funniest things like that happen to me. Now, in this one, I have a feeling that that those might be the Blakes.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, you said that you had a bowling alley and tennis courts and things. Did they later become the Ward property down there?
The Wards, Mr. Ward, I talked to her just the other day and she told me this. Mr. Ward bought his property, not Mr. Ward, Mr. Billings.
Oh, yes.
Bought the property when Mill Valley came into existence, which was in, 95, wasn't it? 90-something. And but he do you know what her name is? No. She's married to an army man.
Marion Ward or Jean?
Well, there are two of them, and I can't remember which mm-hmm. one I've been talking to. But they're back living in the house that was at the gate of the Billings
mm-hmm.
property.
Mm-hmm.
But she has a deed from my grandmother, and I presume it was straightening up the line and
mm-hmm.
giving him. You see. When you take up this property, usually there's a creek. You own to the middle of the creek.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why. That seems a very strange thing. But he bought the
other side
thing and bought the whole creek.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really? Oh.
Mm-hmm. That went in front of his place.
Mm-hmm.
There was a dam. And then the Billings came above that. And then see if I can see any more.
of the names that I see from the early days, and I don't know whether I mentioned these before, Mr. and Mrs. the William Thomases and their whole family used to stay, and the oldest Thomas once told me that her father was the only one who built his own cottage, and she said, I don't know what the arrangement was, but some kind of an arrangement, I suppose, that it reverted to the Blythedale owners when they didn't want to use it anymore, but they built their own, but they always ate in the main dining room. Everybody ate in the main dining room. Then there were the Leonard Abbotts and their son Leonard that came, and they were very well known in San Francisco. And earlier than that, in the 1880s, the Ernest Ransoms, Mr. and Mrs., and Mr. and Mrs. Wigmore, and a Kate Ransom. She was a Mrs. Bess later. And the Schmedbergs, the McBeans, the Malcolm Molders, and the Reddings.
It must have been kind of an inn place to come to.
Yes, well, it weren't also in that, you must remember, that was before the days of the automobile. Before people went for weekends someplace, they went and settled down and spent the entire summer.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh, another person that I found a little piece of a bill that somebody sent me for the board of his horses, and that was Mr. Sutro.
Oh.
And his coachman, Mr. Ferguson, was his coachman, apparently. And there, the Geislers, the Bifuses, the Houghtons, Ruth Houghton and her brother, and the Chris Millers, and the Cliffords.
Well, I
Maud Payne.
I suspect that it was the Blythedale thing that put Mill Valley. I see from that article that it was your father that built the Mountain Railroad. Do you remember anything about that?
Yes, I don't remember the very beginning. Well, I do remember some things about the very beginnings of it. I can remember that he went to down south on a trip to Mountain Low, where they had some kind of a scenic railway that went up to the top of the mountain. And that made kind of a great impression on me. I don't quite know why, but and I remember that they were having difficulties with a sort of a strike against it, with a one-man strike, and I don't blame it much, because the train was going to go right across the street in Lower Mill Valley, and then right underneath practically underneath their porch, which hung over the place a couple of times a day, but in the end they settled that. And I do remember hearing that they put him on a flat car. The road was only built a little way up. In fact, they started up at the top of the grade, at the top of the mountain, and built down. They started at the bottom and built up, cleared and built up. And he was put on a freight car and pushed up the track. It was a great honor for him to be the first one to ride on the mountain railway. So it all ended amicably. But there was a lot of difficulty. I remember just vaguely hearing about it too, because the people up the canyon were bringing suits to try to stop it, just the way, you know, it does cause a little trouble and excitement. I can remember that when I later owned a house in Mill Valley, it was up on the top of the hill when the mountain train went up. At a certain point, it would hit, my house would shake.
Really?
Just like an earthquake, just a little moon thing that didn't last very long. But apparently, when it was ready to open, they had a large party under the redwood trees in Mill Valley near the dam, and entertained the newspaper people, reporters and so forth, and took them up on the opening day. They entertained them with bottles of champagne, popping, and so forth. I had a hard time forgiving the mountain road, because there was this perfectly darling little dam in which you could swim, and which was big enough to ride around on a rowboat. And the tracks went right over the trestle, went right over the dam and ruined it forever.
Oh.
Which just broke my heart.
Mm-hmm.
But that was, otherwise than that, we'd had wonderful times going up the mountain and coming down in the gravity car.
I wonder how they got equipment up to start grading down.
Well, I guess they camped up there. I don't think they put the rails. And somebody told me I was wrong about this, but I don't think I'm wrong when I remember things so very vividly. I can remember that there's the Bonnot, which is part about almost halfway, just about halfway up, I think, maybe a little bit more. And my recollection was that the people that were coming down and the people that were going up didn't quite meet, and so they had to work out some way for a proper grade, and so they made this thing where they circled around and had a little more room, and it was a little plateau where they met with a wonderful view, so they saw it from, it was really a nice mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But somebody said, oh, no, that isn't the reason at all. And I'm sure I heard my father tell that tale
yes.
half a dozen times.
Well, I'll rely on your memory.
And then we'd come down in the gravity car. And then later, there were plans to go to take it down to the Bolinas side, to Stinson Beach. And that didn't work out in the end.
They did take it down into Muir Woods, finally.
Oh, yes, they took it down into mm-hmm. Muir Woods. And then Mr. Kent and my father were very great friends, and they did all these things together. And we spent one summer, I think only one, on the sand spit. Mr. Kent was buying all that property, and my father was doing all sorts of, was planning to bring the train down and helping Mr. Kent open up the property. There had to be to get from the main road around the bay, there had to be a little causeway over to the sand spit, and there had to be a fill. So my one recollection of my youth was the horror of my father getting so upset because every winter the causeway washed out. The causeway's washed out again, and then they had to rebuild it. But there was some litigation about Mr. Kent's acquiring this property from the original Bolinasites. And the reason we spent the summer on the sand spit was in order to counteract the squatters that were squatting up at the other end of the sand spit, and I was about 12 or 13, I guess, and we were told never to go up to the end of the sand spit because there were squatters up there. Well, I didn't quite know what squatters were. Since then, I think I've met a lot of the squatters in my Bolinas sojourns. And we had a little house built up, little square thing built up on the top of piers, because they didn't know whether the water went over in the winter time, the big storms. And that was a kitchen and a dining room, and there was a Chinese cook that made the most wonderful mashed potatoes with a brown crust that he thick brown crust that he put on them. I don't know how he did that. And he made marvelous kites, box kites, and they had a bamboo strip at the top that would sing when they went up. And the higher it went, the harder they'd sing, which was very exciting. And we had a horse, we had three or four tents with wooden floors, and the sand would blow in under the floors and blow into the beds and blow everywhere. And we had this great big horse tent, and an old horse and a cart. I can't remember. I don't know why I didn't have my pony over there. Maybe it was too hard to get him over. We used to go every night and every afternoon. We'd go over to the Belvedere Ranch and get eggs and milk and for the next day. And used to swim every day and had a lot of our school friends visiting us. It was lots of fun for us, but I don't know about my poor mother. I must have been a little grim for her. But we had a wonderful time. Flowing and turning it on. This is a little advertisement that was in something for the Blithedale Hotel, and it said that they could accommodate 125 in rooms, adults in rooms, 1250 and 15 per week, in tents, 10 per week, special rates for children, families or parties upon application, address, something Barber, manager, Mill Valley, Marin County.
And this was in 1908, this advertisement appeared?
Well, I guess so. I don't know why that 1908 is there. Otherwise.
125. That's really a lot of people. We seem to have more or less covered the early days of the Blithedale Hotel. Now, when did you move back to Mill Valley, Aunt Dolly?
Well, I was born in San Rafael. My grandfather, Eldridge, built a house there in 1881. And that's where my mother lived. There, her mother had died, and my grandfather, whom I don't remember, has died before I was born, moved over there. And he was very much interested in the gasworks. And my uncle, Alan Lee, was in charge of the gasworks. And there used to be meetings in their front living room. And I remember sitting on laps while meetings were going on. It was very sort of an informal affair. And Mother, in something that she wrote about her early days, wrote that she went down to Blithedale, saw Blithedale for the first time in about 1881. And then I suppose she began to be interested and went down again later. And there was a courting going on. And in 1886, she and my father were married. And my father, after their wedding, they went immediately from the wedding ceremony down to Southern California for a few days of honeymoon, and then from there, Chicago, where my father took care of Mr. Kent's business, Mr. Albert Kent. I call him Grandpa, Grandpa Kent, Senior. And they stayed there for about a year. And they came back, and John was to the San Rafael house. John was born, and I was born there. And I don't remember the first time we stayed in Blithedale. We didn't go there every summer. We used to just go there sometimes, but I remember that one summer we spent in the old, original old rooms, the little old house up over the dining room of the hotel. There were two or three rooms there. And then another summer at the back of the hotel, and another summer in the green roof cottage. And then in the 90s, my father began to plan and build the mountain road. And he built a little cabin just outside, a little tiny house just outside the hotel grounds. They stopped at that time at a gate, the road that went down to the dam, where he could go. It was one room and a dining and a kitchen and a bathroom, and a big table out in back where we would eat sometimes. And he used to go down there and stay when he had a mountain road business, when he was kept over and too tired to come back. So I used to go down, stay with him very often, not to keep him company, I'm sorry to say, but because then I could see my beloved little Lester Thompson on the train in the morning. He would commute to San Francisco, and I would be commuting up to San Rafael, but at least I'd get a glimpse of this gorgeous creature for about 10 or 15 minutes. And instead of filial love, I'm afraid that was what it was. But later, when we began to go to Blithedale more often every summer, he added three bedrooms and a bath to that house, so it made a very comfortable, plenty of room for the family to live in. Turned off. Then later, when I was married, Mother decided as a wedding present that she would build us a house on the property that was right behind this little house of hers. And she built us a very, very comfortable house there. I'd hate to tell you, I don't think it cost very much to build, and it was on the property, but I'd hate to tell you what it sold for. The last time it was sold, it was just the most fantastic price. It grew into quite a large house because it was on a steep side hill, and so there was rooms underneath, and then the living room and bedroom floor in which we were. And then we finished off the attic as the children grew older. So there were two big bathrooms and two big bedrooms upstairs, beside a lot of extra space still in hallways. And
did you sell to the Hayakawas?
No. We sold, I can't remember what their name were now. I went after Mother's death, I went east to help Sally with something. I think another baby was coming or something of that kind. And I said to by that time we'd bought our little house in Bolinas, and we loved the Bolinas house, and we went there every single weekend. And I said to Jim, well, let's sell a Mill Valley house and rent a little apartment in San Francisco and then keep Bolinas, go to Bolinas, which we did, and it was a very satisfactory arrangement. I used to come back from taking care of a Bolinas garden, and here would be the hydrangeas in the Mill Valley garden all wilted and needing water, and it was just too much of a good thing. So that's, and we went there for a good many years. We bought that, well, in about the middle 30s we bought that, and until Jim's death we kept going there until 1960. And I kept on going for a couple of years, and then I decided I shouldn't be driving a car, and if you don't drive a car, you can't get to Bolinas.
No.
Mm-hmm. At home, which was, when I see these young people now that think they're so smart about talking home voice, well, we certainly did it in those days.
Yes, I was born at home.
Were you born at home, too? Mm-hmm. Well, Sally was born in the old San Rafael house, and Jimmy was born in the Mill Valley house.
Mm-hmm.
Most remarkable birth in the world, because I don't understand it still. The doctor came down from San Rafael, and I think it was a stormy night, and he thought he'd better spend the night. And Mother came up to the house, we played bridge, the doctor and Jim and stuff, yes. And I went to bed, and in the morning there was Jimmy.
Mm-mm.
I don't understand it.
Easiest birth I ever heard of.
The last bridge ad. Mm-hmm. I think I said, well, I think I want to go to bed now, so I went to bed, and that was it.
That's too easy.
It must have had a little whiff of something, I guess.
Were you one of the founding members of the Outdoor Art Club?
No, and I was never an Outdoor Art Clubber.
Mm.
I was one of the first PTA Ikes, and I was about the second president, I think. I think Mrs. Finn was the first president, and she died. And was I green? I didn't know anything about what PTA, Sally was just beginning to go there, what it was all about. But, and I used to get, and I can't remember what this was about, but I used to get anonymous letters, some of them telling me I was too old, that I ought to know better, and some telling me I was too young to understand. I can't remember now. I wish I'd kept some of them. I just can't remember. One of them had a little pressed violet inside of it, and I've always thought that it was from Mrs. Little.
Oh.
It was, you know, kind of being kind to me, but helpful. But anyway, what that was about, I don't know. And then Mildred Erskine and I, staffed through the PTA, established a very simple hot lunch, just a bowl of soup. And the bowl, and we had a little money, and we bought little Chinese bowls, and we bought, the soup was to be brought up from, the soup was to be brought up from Mr. Bagshaw, not Fred, but Fred's father's store, and delivered at noontime, 5 days a week. And then we heated it on a coal oil stove and dished it out to the, well, one day, It was different soup every day. One day it was bean soup, and unfortunately it had gotten a little scorched, and there was an awful to-do through the PTA meetings about the scorched bean soup. But this I've never told anyone, and I don't think I should tell you now, but maybe I will. Another day, when we got down to the bottom of the bowl, to the pitcher of soup, that it was in a big milk can, I think, there was a large cockroach. We kept that a deep dark secret. Yes. No one but Mildred and I saw it. No one knows it to this day. But now the world will know.
Now the world will know.
But I didn't never heard of anybody dying from eating a cockroach, do you?
No, as a matter of fact, I think some cultures fry them and eat them.
Well, a man on one of the talk shows the other night was boasting about the worms he ate and how he'd give these lectures and then he'd pick out a nice juicy earthworm and eat it. And it was something to do with nutrition and so forth. And they were very nutritious. They were just full of things that are good for you.
Probably those children that got the cockroach.
Almost always half the room would have to get up and go out. Margaret, is that a
Margot
name? Margot Patterson?
Doss.
Mm-hmm. Suggested that I go over with her sometime. And I'm going to call her up because I would love to do it. And walk up from the trees that was supposed to be the smallest park in the world, and then on up past the green roof cottage from which all the surveying was done. When you read about anything, it says the green roof cottage and the Diablo Meridian. And then you go on up, and the old cement porch of the hotel was there, which I think of being something very new, but I suppose was put on in about 1908 maybe, or 7 or 8. And then on up past where the dam was, and then go on past the gates of the Japanese gates of the marshes, mm-hmm. That's something she could write about, and up to where along the mountain tracks, the trail of the old mountain tracks, where it went, just starts going up the grade,
mm-hmm.
and then back down Corner Madera on the other side to the old homes of the Billings, and and that makes a very nice circle.
Yes,
and
it does.
A very nice little walk. There was one place that I wish was still there, but somebody told me it wasn't, and that was just above Corner Madera, when you get across from the Billings and the bridges and the hazes, you went up hill a little way. There was a narrow path, but a well-kept little path, and it was the very mossy bank. Did you ever go on that?
No.
It was just a darling path. Now, Mildred Erskine and I used to, every once in a while, when there'd be a flower show, we'd have a moss exhibit, and we didn't know one thing about moss, but nevertheless, we found out that there were just loads of different varieties, and you could make the loveliest table of mosses with buckeyes over them and with moss hanging from the buckeye trees and pick out the proper names in the group. So we did that with great success at several flower shows in San Francisco and in Mill Valley and different places.
Mm.
The dam was, well, if you know where Benny Upham now lives.
No.
If you went in Ben Upham's backyard and walked down the hill, you would see the edge of the end of the dam that went over the creek there. It's about where Cottage Avenue comes down from Eldridge Avenue, if you walk straight down there. But of course, they're everybody's backyard,
mm-hmm.
and you can't get in to really see it.
That, like where Mrs. What was that woman with the French name and the British accent? Back in down on her house. Is the Green Roof House still there?
The Green Roof House is still there. We spent one summer in the Green Roof House. I think I was about 8 years old. And I can remember my father was sick, and for some reason or other, my mother thought she ought to have a doctor. And she thought of Dr. Berkey, who was up on the hill. And of course, there weren't any telephones. And so I was sent on my pony. It was a great adventure for me to ride outside and go up on this hill to the Berkeys to ask if Dr. Berkey could come down and see my father,
mm.
which I did with great
is the Green Roof?
Well, the Green Roof Cottage, as you first come in past the smallest park in the world, I can't tell you sitting here, but it's the third or the fourth house on the right-hand side.
Oh, it is?
It's a little plaster house. Hmm. And why it's so different from all the other houses that were built. But I'm sure it was built in those very, very early days. Mm-hmm. It's an entirely different construction. It must have been more professionally done than mm-hmm. some of the others.
Hmm. I suppose planted those fruit trees.
Well, either my, that was in my, what I considered my grandmother's garden, either my grandmother or Mrs. Allen's grandmother. I mean, they I don't know how long that he was there, you mm-hmm. see. That's why I wish she knew something more about it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
She did say to me, a doctor, I said, well, what happened to her? Think of the loneliness of that woman with the man away and a child. Because she couldn't have had the child after he came back.
No.
He was dead and gone.
Mm-hmm.
Living there all alone. Mm-hmm. I mean, no telephone, nothing.
No. No train, no.
How did she get her food?
Well,
all that sort of thing.
She must have eaten a lot of fruit.
I don't see.
Goodness.
But what I want to know is how long after it was. Now, Mrs., did she stay there? Mrs. Allen did say to me, a doctor befriended her, so I pricked up and I said, oh, was it Dr. Cushing? He said, no, it wasn't Dr. Cushing. Well, what did she do? This makes me more dismal than ever. She said, well, she went down and she lived in a house that he owned in Tennessee Valley. And of all places to me, Tennessee Valley is the most dismal. I mean, Blithedale had beauty all around, mm-hmm. but Tennessee Valley is the most windswept,
mm-hmm.
dismal.
Oh, yeah.